Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation. Mabel McCormick was tending to her antique shop with her granddaughter when the unthinkable happened. Two men entered the store, brutally murdered Mabel, and drowned her three-year-old granddaughter, all before making their getaway with a few thousand dollars in stolen antiques. The two men end up turning themselves into police, but the outcome of the trial is shocking. Find out what happened and how a lack of justice led to more murder. This is True Crime Cast.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie and John here with a special episode for a whole host of reasons. One, because it's a really good case, but why else is this special, John?
Well, it is special because a patron member has paid for it. So we're going to be doing a case today that one of you all selected, and we're going to say a special thanks right now to Jamie. Jamie paid for a $50 level of True Crime Cast Patreon, and because of that, Jamie got to pick the episode, and we're going to talk about it today.
To be clear, that Jamie is not me. That is a different Jamie.
Yeah, I think it is a different Jamie for sure. Otherwise, it'd be weird for you paying us to do what we normally do.
That's an excellent point.
But we are excited about this case. It's crazy what happened. It's the outcome of everything is crazy. I think we're going to have a lot to say about this case as we go on.
So. This is one specifically that Kyle was very excited to tell us after he had been doing research that he thought this was a really good one. So I'm excited to bring it to you. John, let's just go, man. Get us rolling.
Yeah, I was going to say real quick that next week we're going to have another episode that was also purchased by a Patreon member. So y'all are keeping us busy, but we appreciate it. We really do thank you all so much for joining us over there. Let's go down to, is it Counts, Texas?
That's what we're going to say, yeah.
I was going to say Counts, but that's probably somewhere in Tennessee. No, it's Counts, Texas. You probably haven't heard of it, Jamie, because it's a really tiny town. It's in East Texas. Not a whole lot of people live there. I think the biggest claim to fame for this town is being home to a well-known rodeo star. Jamie, you're from Harlan, Kentucky. I'm sure you've watched a few rodeo in your day. Do you know any famous rodeo stars?
You know, Harlan's not hardly Texas. I think the guy you're referring to is Cody Teal. Is that right?
Yeah, he's famous right now, so I guess that's who we're talking about. I can't personally say that I know who he is, but hey, good job. Hope those 8 seconds are fun.
Yeah.
You're never going to see me on the back of a bull on purpose. If you do see me on the one, please call 911 promptly. Anyway, so there's not a lot else that we know about Counts, Texas. There's about 2,000 residents who were enjoying a quiet and unassuming lifestyle back in the 1970s, and that's where we're going to go for our story today. Just days into 1972, this quiet, happy small town where nobody ever locked their doors was shattered when one of the most horrific murders in East Texas history was discovered. So at the center of this case is going to be an elderly woman and a toddler. The two vicious criminals who went through great lengths to make their murders as grisly and inhumane as possible, all for just a few thousand dollars. And less than 20 years later, the killers were out of custody when an anonymous tip put them back on law enforcement's radar. So, Jamie, we're going to talk about this case. Why don't you go ahead and get us rolling on the details?
On January 5th in 1972, Maybelle McCormick, who was 54 years old, went to the antique shop that she owned on Highway 69, just outside of Counts. In a phone call with her husband that morning, she told him about two men that had come into the store, and they were just acting kind of odd. It wasn't like they were in there shopping for something specific or even browsing. They just seemed weird, like they were up to something shady. And she said she had seen them in there before, and it just kind of made her uncomfortable. Later that afternoon, a delivery man arrived at the antique store where the two men, matching the description that Maybelle provided to her husband, had met and signed a receipt from a delivery man. So they received a package at the antique store.
Isn't that a little odd? Like, I usually receive my packages at home.
Yeah.
Maybe that's different in counts Texas. I don't know.
Well, I guess if you're doing something shady and you don't know what want people to know your address, then you have them meet you in a public place.
That's true.
That's different
than your house.
I've had pizza delivered to other places before when they wouldn't deliver all the way to my house.
Because you're doing shady stuff?
I would meet them at a store. It's good pizza. Later that day, Maybelle's body, as well as that of her 3-year-old granddaughter, Leslie Bowman, were discovered in the shop after emergency personnel had arrived to the scene to extinguish an arson fire on the property. Maybelle had been stabbed repeatedly until she died of those wounds, while her granddaughter had arguably met an even worse death, John. They took this 3-year-old little girl, John, and held her head underwater in the toilet until she drowned. After the murders, the killers had fled the scene, but not before lighting a mattress on fire that they had found on the property to try to destroy evidence that they may have left behind. Maybelle had no known enemies, but as police got to the scene and started their investigation, the motive was pretty clear. Several items worth about $6,000, which in 2020 would be like 40 grand, was missing from the store. Police from across Counts County began a thorough investigation, piecing together the events of the day based on Maybelle's call to her husband, the account from the delivery driver, and investigators knew that they were looking for two young white men driving a green and silver moving truck. Within 24 hours, state officials had mobilized aircrafts to search Counts County and were doing a massive manhunt for two people who fit this description and looking for this vehicle. Sheriff Billy Payne said at the time that of the three double homicides he'd investigated in his career, the McCormick-Bowman case was the worst he had ever seen. And John, I get uncomfortable every time we have a case that talks about a kid being killed, and this one was just brutal.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot imagine having to be one of the first people on the scene to see what was there waiting on him. I mean, she was brutally stabbed, and then when you think that's awful and bad enough by itself, then you move in and see that a 3-year-old has been drowned in the way that she was done, man, that would wreak havoc on anybody's mental health for a long time. So do not envy their jobs at all. So it's really at this point that the case takes a bizarre turn. On January 7th, which would be 2 days after the murders, Dennis Anderson and Fred Young send their families letters kind of confessing to the murders. They tell them that they're sorry for the pain they caused to their loved ones, but they promised that it would be a long time before either of them would be seen again. So the family got these letters, and Jamie, I guess they turned them into police, because right after that, warrants were issued for both of these men for the murders. So a little bit about these guys. Dennis Anderson was 25 years old. Fred Young was 21. And the search for these two men is now well outside of Counts, Texas. Police are focusing all their efforts on a suburb of Houston called Pearland. On January 8th, so 3 days after the murders, Texas Rangers initiated a middle-of-the-night raid on a home associated with the two suspects. So when they get there, in the driveway stood the moving truck that was seen at the crime by a witness. And when they looked inside that truck, they found stolen goods belonging to Mabel McCormick's antique store. The raid confirmed that Anderson and Young were responsible for the murders, but unfortunately, neither of those men were found at this house. I guess they had fled to Mexico 24 hours after the murders. So they're not even in America anymore. They have fled to Mexico. This case had quickly gained notoriety, and the pressure was mounting on police across North America to locate Anderson and Young. As a result, on January 14th, the two suspects flew back into Houston and surrendered themselves to the Texas Rangers. So they felt so bad about what was going on, they actually flew themselves back home and surrendered themselves to the police. Jamie, I would think that you could probably live for a while on the run in Mexico. I mean, do you think that's crazy of me to think that?
No, especially at that time. I'm not exactly sure what the extradition laws are there, but yeah, I mean, people do it all the time. That's a common place to flee, I think.
Yeah. They were charged with 2 counts of murder, and Anderson also was charged with theft. They said that in addition to just the fear of being caught for their crimes, They later said that they met with a Mexican priest and had a conversation with them. And as a result, they had a change of heart and turned themselves in. Because an elderly woman and a toddler had been killed, prosecutors sought the death penalty for both men. Both of them had passed psychiatrics exams, and by April, both had secured a change of venue, as their attorneys argued that in East Texas, there was really no way to give them a fair trial because the coverage of everything that happened was so widespread. The trial was postponed several times, but it finally was going to happen in September of 1973. Anderson changed the course of it by pleading guilty to the murder of Mabel McCormick. He had reached a plea deal to avoid the death penalty by admitting guilt to the McCormick murder.
Yeah, before we go more into the trial, John, I just want to, I guess, ask you about some of these things. Do you buy the Mexican priest story at all?
I feel like when I heard this, this is just a way to start to get some kind of sympathy. Like, I mean, obviously they turned themselves in.
They did come back, yeah.
I don't know if it was because of the priest or because of, again, Edgar Allan Poe's the Telltale Heart. Like, you feel so much guilt and pressure that it's better just to turn yourself in. They may have met with the priest. I'm not sure. But I'm just glad that they came back and are going to be held accountable.
I also find the change of venue interesting. I mean, I know Texas is a gigantic state, but if the coverage is that widespread, is it going to be that much better for them 50 miles down the road?
I mean, this wasn't just a case that was isolated to media in Texas. I mean, this was a nationwide thing. So I don't know how it's going to make all that much of a difference. But I guess in the county, you have people who personally know this lady and that child. So maybe that was going to be tough, but I don't know, man. I think moving to the few county over isn't probably a big deal, but I think everybody is going to have some kind of knowledge about this because of the media coverage.
We'll talk more about that after we take a break, and we'll discuss a turning point in the case as Dennis Ray Anderson turned state's evidence and agreed to testify against Fred Young. Hey guys, Jamie and John here, and we want to tell you how excited we are to be able to offer new merchandise for our podcasts.
Yeah, we have partnered with a company called TeePublic. We have listed the links to our store below in our show notes. We've also put those on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But Jamie, there's a ton of stuff you can find over there.
T-shirts, phone cases, mugs, travel mugs, hoodies, and even masks, John.
There is a ton of new products over there. It's way better than the store we used to have. You can customize your order. Like, if you want a shirt that's yellow or green or blue, whatever, you can make that happen. So go over there and check that out today, and you will not be disappointed.
Anderson agreed to testify against the co-defendant in this case in order to avoid the death penalty. He depicted Young as somebody who willfully committed the theft and murders because of a dire financial situation. He told the court that Young was the one who drowned 3-year-old Leslie Bowman in the toilet, and that Young also held Maybell as Anderson stabbed her to death. So he admitted he was the one committing the murder. He removed himself from the murder of the child. But he's trying to pin a lot of this here on Young. And if it was for the financial situation, John, they went to Mexico and left the truck full of the stuff they sold. So it's not like they got it, or the stuff they stole. It's not like they got it and made money off of it.
Yeah, they had it left in the truck, so they didn't even make any cash off of it before they left.
In what is an absolutely heartbreaking and chilling testimony, on the stand, Anderson would say that Young invited Leslie to sit on his lap and read a children's story while she had her breakfast. And they did that just moments before he killed her and her grandmother.
I don't get that. I mean, I really don't. I know that it's hard to talk about, but I don't understand the thought process of any of this crap, especially
that. Like, that's sadistic.
Like, how? I don't get it, man. I'm sorry. I know I'm rambling. I don't get it.
Young also testified in his own defense, which we don't see a ton, a tactic that it almost always comes back to backfire on you. He claimed he had nothing to do with the murders, that he had tried to stop Anderson from killing both of the victims because he was in a state of shock and wanted everything to stop. He went on to say that he had no idea that Leslie was killed until they were already on their way to Mexico and saw it in a newspaper. So two very conflicting stories here. Anderson saying that Young killed the little girl and held the woman while she was killed, and that it was his idea to do the robbery in the first place. And Young is saying that he didn't even know that the girl had been killed, and he tried to stop Anderson from killing Maybell. So very conflicting stories here, and it's kind of up to the jury to decide who's lying. And their decision was clear, but very confusing at the same time. On September 23rd, Fred Young was found guilty of murder for Maybell McCormick. He was sentenced to 5 years of probation.
I'm gonna stop you there. I was reading ahead a little bit, but did you say 5 years and only probation, not 5 years in a cell? And why only 5 years?
Yeah, a lot of confusion there. They said they thought he was guilty, but he was just given 5 years probation for the murder of Maybell McCormick. The trial for the death of Leslie Bowman started in January of 1974. He doubled down on his story. He said he wasn't even aware she had been killed and had nothing to do with it. His defense portrayed Anderson as the mastermind behind the robbery and the murder of both people. Young would again take a stand in his own defense. And almost 2 years to the day after the murders, Young was found guilty of the murder of 3-year-old Leslie Bowman. Here, he was sentenced to 10 years of probation.
So he confessed to killing a lady, and he's not spending any time behind bars. That can't be right.
Well, I guess the letter to his family was a confession that he was involved in the murders, but when he took the stand, he said he had nothing to do with either murder. And just as surprised as you and I are, John, people around town, around that community, were so outraged that there was a state law proposed soon after the trial that would ensure that judges, not juries, decided the punishment of convicted felons. So in these cases, the jury said, yes, you're guilty of murder, but they decided on these light punishments. And John, as if this story isn't bizarre enough, 17 years after the murders, on July 21st of 1989, Dennis Anderson's finally released from prison for the murder of Maybell McCormick. Remember, he took a plea deal to testify against Young so he wouldn't get the death penalty, and he ended up spending 17 years in prison, and Young didn't go to prison.
This baffles me. We're talking about a small town in Texas. How are both of these guys not dead? And I say that, like, it might sound harsh, but Texas is known for being, you know, pretty strict on their death penalty. And these guys are responsible for murdering a grandmother and a 3-year-old. How are they still alive?
Yeah, usually if you kill somebody, Texas will kill you back.
Yeah.
So
swift justice down there. And I mean, I'm not bashing them. Like, it's good that there's justice being served down there. But this story baffles me because they're out of jail and they're in Texas.
Well, obviously, Anderson was not reformed. When he got out of prison, he continued in his criminal dealings, including one incident, John, that resulted in a woman being murdered and placed in a barrel at his home. 20 years after his release, so that would have been in 2009, Anderson's next brush with the law resulted in 5 months in jail for assault during a robbery attempt of an individual. Not long after that, an anonymous tip was called into Crime Stoppers on October 18th of 2010. In that call, the caller notifies Houston police that they should be investigating a home on Split Oak Court in Houston. The caller claimed that the resident of that house, whose name was Dennis Anderson, had told them that he had strangled a woman and had hid her body at his home. 3 days later, on October 21st, law enforcement discovered a rusty barrel in Anderson's backyard. The barrel was entirely sealed, and police had to remove several bolts before they could even get access to the contents. But when they finally did, John, they were horrified. Inside of that barrel was a decomposing female's body. Her killer had securely tied her feet together using weed eater wire. Her body was under tightly packed dirt, but her head was above the dirt and visible when police opened the barrel.
I'm going to stop you right there just to process this a little bit. This guy is responsible for some of the most horrific scenes that I think we've ever spoke about on this show. And we've talked about a lot of jacked up stuff. But could you, I mean, again, put yourself in the shoes. You're opening up this barrel and the first thing you see is a decomposed head looking back at you. And then whatever, almost 35, 40 years earlier, you walk in to see a grandmother stabbed to death and a toddler had been drowned. Like, this guy's a freaking animal. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's amazing that he went those 20 years without being caught for some kind of violent act, because obviously it's still a part of his DNA. It's a part of who he is. The woman in the barrel had on no clothing except for a blue T-shirt with a floral design that had the word Cherokee on it. And as a resident of the house, and because of his past as a violent criminal, he's obviously the person of interest. However, nobody had seen him since 2 days after the original Crime Stoppers call, which was 1 day before the raid on his property where they found the barrel. A warrant was issued for his arrest, and he was charged with tampering with evidence for his concealment of a dead body.
So at this point, the hunt is on for Anderson, who was 64 years old at the time. And of course, this was quickly assigned to federal authorities, as there was reason to believe that he had crossed state lines in his attempt to evade arrest. And it also makes sense. I mean, heck, the last time he went to Mexico. So this guy is a definite flight risk, and it's untelling where he's going to end up. On October 29th, the marshals notify the public that they believe Anderson had fled the Houston area on a Greyhound bus. Marshals were able to track his movements until he arrived in Louisiana, where they had lost his trail. Not surprisingly, they told the public to be aware of Anderson, as he was most likely armed and certainly dangerous, having now been tied to 3 homicides. Police also indicated that Anderson was likely en route to Boston or Fort Lauderdale.
Stop. Those are 2 very different places, very many hundred miles apart.
Did he have reason to be in either of those?
I'm assuming there was some kind of connection to those areas, but if you're just going on a broad search, that's a pretty big a range. If you're looking to trail him and get him before he gets somewhere, how are you going to trap him between here and Boston if you're also looking between here and Florida, which Florida would have obviously been closer to Louisiana at that point? And you talked about him being a flight risk, John. This was 2010. This was 10 years ago. This was after 9/11. I've never ridden a Greyhound bus, but I know, like, if he had gotten on a plane, he would have been caught. Like, you have to provide lots of identification to get on a plane. I'm assuming a Greyhound bus ticket can just be purchased with cash.
I'm assuming you can pay your fee and get on a bus, no questions asked, is kind of how I assume. But like you said, I've never ridden on a Greyhound bus, and hopefully don't anytime soon. Buses are terrible. However, just 3 days after releasing that information, the criminal and homicidal dealings of Dennis Ray Anderson came to a close. On November 1st, 2010, 64-year-old Anderson was found dead in a Florida motel room. So inside his pocket was a handwritten note that confessed to strangling the woman in the barrel, alleging that she had stolen money from him. He wrote, "At no time did anyone know of the murder. I regret this greatly, but it happened." I don't know if you found this odd, but I found it odd that he said, "At no time did anyone know that this happened." That's probably him saying, somebody knew, it's not his fault, it's my fault. I mean, am I reading that incorrectly?
No, I mean, it's like a time when a kid comes up to you and automatically is like, "I was nowhere near the lamp."
Yeah.
Well, you knocked the lamp over.
You broke a lamp,
like,
didn't you?
They're trying to cover for themselves before they're ever accused. And maybe he was trying to save somebody here from being implicated as part of the crime. But I do think that makes people look guiltier than it does if he had said nothing like that.
His cause of death was listed as suicide. He had taken straps from his boots and made those into a noose in order to hang himself there in his motel room. Fred Young had died a year earlier on October 4th, 2009. He was 59 years old at the time of his death. So the remains found in the barrel at Anderson's home, Jamie, it took them a year to identify the woman in the barrel. Stacy Leanne Lutz Anderson was the wife of Dennis Anderson, and she had been in the barrel for over 10 years, placing her death somewhere between 1999 and 2000.
So she had been in the barrel that was properly sealed for 10 years. And they, when they opened it, they saw a head that was being decomposed.
I mean, it was basically a skeleton at that point.
You think so? Or do you think the environment of the sealed barrel with the dirt could have preserved it some?
Yeah, I think it was mostly skeletal, but there was probably some tissue. And I say that because they had to take DNA samples from her sister in order to kind of match those with the body in the barrel. And when they showed up as a match, then they were able to confirm that it was Stacy's body. So it was mostly skeletal, but there was definitely some tissue that was there still. So horrifying. I mean, this is so awful.
Well, let's play this out. Let's say this happens in the year 2000. What happens in the year 2010 for that call to come into Crime Stoppers? And then how does Dennis know about that call to flee? Do you think there's a chance that he called and turned himself in?
I don't. I think that if you have a barrel in your possession for 10 years and it has your wife's body in it, somebody's going to know about it. And I think maybe he got, I don't know, I'm kind of playing this out in my head. Maybe his best friend knew about it. They had some kind of falling out. So the friend calls it in. Maybe that friend calls him back and says, hey, listen here, crap head. I've just called the police to tell them that you have your wife's body in a barrel. And then that prompted him to get the crap out of town.
And then put in the note that nobody else knew about it so that his best friend wouldn't be
even though his best friend may have been the one, he maybe just didn't want to flip on his best friend. I don't know. That's kind of in my head how I see this going down. That doesn't mean it's the truth.
Right. I don't know. I could see a scenario where he at some point made the call, decided he would flee, and then, I don't know, maybe if he made the call, he kills himself at his home before police get there. I don't know. The whole scenario of it being 10 years old and all of a sudden just getting a tip that leads to a body is not something that happens a lot.
Jamie, in the 10 years that he had this barrel, he moved several times. So each time he moved, he had to pack up this barrel and take it with him. So it's not like you put her in the barrel, you put it in your barn, and you don't think about it anymore. He had to actively move this barrel numerous times as he moved around from place to place. They had married each other in 1997. That was 8 years after he was released from prison for the murder that he committed. And he was over 20 years older than she was. The last verified sighting of Stacy Anderson was in 1999. Although neither Dennis nor anyone else in her life ever reported her missing. So they just basically left her to decompose in this barrel for over a decade in his backyard. I don't know why anybody else wouldn't notify that she was missing. I mean, I understand he's not going to report that. Why call that in and immediately start your own scrutiny? But it breaks my heart that she doesn't have anybody else in her life that notices she's gone and calls her in as a missing person. That's so sad, man.
Yeah, I mean, you think about her family members and maybe she was estranged from them. Family friends, like how did their family friends not, maybe he told them that she had just run off and she had left him and was gone and got them to believe that. At this point, everybody had a cell phone, so surely somebody's going to notice that she's not answering her phone anymore. Not sure of her employment status, but coworkers could certainly have called that in. So yeah, for nobody to mention it and her not to be listed anywhere as a missing person it's just a little baffling to me.
As if this story couldn't possibly get any sadder. I told you that they pulled DNA from her sister to be able to match her. They didn't pull it from a living sister. Her sister was a victim of a homicide in 1990. So they went back and they pulled samples from her autopsy as a way to match those to Stacy. So this is just tragic all the way around. It was, like I said, a match, and they found out that it was Stacy.
Yeah, John, I mean, I mentioned maybe she was estranged from her family, but to know that she had a sister that had been murdered as well, and not to do too much speculation, but Dennis Anderson was out of prison when her sister was murdered for a year. And that's not to say he had anything to do with it, but I don't know, for people to get so murdered, it's unlikely. How likely is it that two sisters would be murdered by different people 20 years apart?
It's terrible, man.
I guess 10 years apart. They found her 20 years later.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, this case, We've covered like serial killers. We've covered, you know, some of the most awful things in all of humanity. But for whatever reason, man, this one really gets to me. I think the reason that it gets to me so bad is the lack of justice. And we talk all the time about, is justice served? Was justice served? And this is just an overwhelming no. How in the world, in America, but specifically Texas, is this guy ever free to see the light of day after he murdered a 54-year-old grandmother and a 3-year-old baby? It blows my mind, and quite frankly, I'm fidgety over here because I'm so angry. Like, there should be no reason he's ever out of jail again.
Yeah, big fat no on the justice question for me, too. And I mean, it's not just him. Like, he did serve 17 years. Is that enough for murdering two people? No chance. No chance. But Fred Young got probation for committing two murders. He was found guilty of two murders.
How is that possible? Because you testified against your buddy?
No, he was the one that got testified against.
It makes no sense. I mean, like, legitimately, why does that happen?
I guess, again, speculation, that they had no choice but to say that he was there and a part of the murder, but he did a good job of convincing them that he was coerced or didn't take the lead role, and that's why jurors shouldn't give sentences. That should be up to judges, and I'm shocked that that was even allowed at that time in the early 70s, that juries could make those decisions, because that just sounds like an awful idea. Or at least they should be given minimums. Hey, this person was found guilty of murder. You can't give them less than 20 years in prison.
Yeah. There needs to be at least a minimum sentence. But, I mean, again, this was back in the 70s, so a lot's have changed, and now it's not like that. But here's what – I mean, you can tell me if I'm wrong, man, but I'm thinking, like, you would think that a long time ago in Texas, it would have been harder for people, not easier. Like, you would think that we would need to rein Texas in a little bit and say, you can't murder them without at least first having a trial.
Yeah.
Like, but here we are talking about how somebody was just basically given a slap on the wrist for murdering two people. It honestly blows my mind.
And then, obviously, the justice not being served in the murders of McCormick and Bowman led to Stacy Leanne Lutz Anderson's murder. So yeah. A lack of justice led to further death, and that's horrific.
And there was really no justice for her either, because he had committed suicide after fleeing Houston, and he was never put before the courts again. So, I mean, I know he'll never be able to murder anybody else again because he's not alive, but still, I think I would like to see some kind of justice done for her and her family, but at least he's never going to do it again. So,
shout out to Other Jamie for getting us to do this case. As far as I can tell, it hasn't been covered on other podcasts, available on iTunes at least. So thanks for asking us to do it. It was certainly an interesting one that I think needs to be heard and needs to be shared. And I hope our audience found it as interesting as we did.
Jamie, thank you so much. And Jamie, thank you so much for being here with me. And thank you all for continuing to plug along with us during this COVID-19 and listening along. And we really appreciate all you all.
Yep. Don't forget that we have a new store, mugs, masks, shirts of all kinds. Let us know if you do buy merchandise off of TeePublic for True Crimecast. Please send us a picture of you wearing it. We'd love to have some of that. We'll put it on our social media.
Yep. There's a lot of different styles and options available. We have different logos. We have different, you can choose colors for everything that you want. It's a lot of fun, and we look forward to seeing those pictures. Jamie, I think that's it. If you haven't already, leave a rating and review on iTunes. And until next crime, this has been True Crimecast.
You've listened to True Crimecast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.